Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the poet Robert Miltner. Robert Miltner's collection of prose poems, Hotel Utopia, was selected by National Book Award finalist Tim Siebels as a winner of the New Rivers Press Book Prize and was a finalist for the Ohioan Book Award in Poetry. He is also the author of over a dozen chapbooks and a limited editions, including Against the Simple, Wick Chapbook Award, and Eurydice Rising, Redberry Editions Award. His collection of short fiction, And Your Bird Can Sing, came out this spring from Bottom Dog Press. An associate professor of English at Kent State University at Stark, Miltner is on the poetry and fiction faculty of and is Kent campus coordinator for the Northeast Ohio MFA in creative writing. He edits the Raymond Carver Review. Hi, Robert. How are you?
Hi, Lauren. It's wonderful to be here in Pittsburgh.
Yes, we are very excited to have you. Would you like to begin by reading some poems?
I'll do that. And I'm going to open with the only poem I've ever written that actually has Pittsburgh appear in it. It seemed appropriate. This is Jack, Neil, and a 49 Hudson. It's based on a lino cut by Mark Snyder, a printmaker who lived in Pittsburgh for a time when I first met him. Jack, Neil, and a 49 Hudson. In the last year of the first half of the modern century, Mao, that khaki emperor, was entering Beijing. Salinger was finishing Catcher in the Rye, and Ginsberg was on the roof beginning to howl. My father was walking away from the punch press at Republic Steel in Cleveland and driving off a company man in his first company car to have lunch in Pittsburgh with a client where they would talk bolts and golf over cocktails and steak. My lace-curtain West Side Irish mother was in her eighth month waddling with me, and with my year-and-a-half older brother in tow, catching his breath. And in Detroit, 160 miles or so north, a 49 Hudson was rolling off the automobile assembly line, its odometer at zero, an open mouth O, marveling at the new highway system that Jack and Neil would drive in it, a postmodern holy trinity going coast to coast, back and forth, over and over, because they could, because it was not about having or even about being, it was just about moving. Their lust for wandering never satisfied, sighs and laughter like exhaust admitted into the air of the high-octane world in which I was being born, gasping for breath. This is a piece I wrote for writers who are silenced or imprisoned or disappeared. Uninhabited World. Our village was all the world we needed. We bred red birds until we could afford to have babies. At night, our bodies were string beans in a box. You worked so hard your nails cracked while my hands bled from the sharp stones, relics I dug from the dirt so we could sow seed in the fields. I set down my hoe when the government forces trampled the oats and planted landmines to explode under the insurgents' feet. While they rounded up goats and ducks and the other young men, we slipped through shadows from our home to a farm shed at the village edge. Do you remember how we awoke to the patch of blue sky in the roof, to the yellow birds nesting in the eaves, to the kick of the army boots and the gun butts? We looked like sardines removed from the can. At the refugee camp, we were pea pods and sheep, stripped and shorn. Each morning, I see laden carts push towards the open pit over the small hill beyond which the wind goes to die. Last month, I aged 1,000 years. This week, another 100 more. Salt soon will settle on my shadow, my bones covered in lime. I dream my body is a white bird that flies around this beating world. You will know it's me, floating like a kite, the skeleton holding an unsigned poem. This is Blue House. I did the early drafts of this when I was in Mexico City at Coyoacan at Casa Azul, which is Frida Kahlo's house, and I marveled at how there was more Diego Rivera present there than Frida Kahlo. Blue House. She was broken. Her piñata had spilled its candy to the floor. She wanted to be whole. He was larger than life, complete of himself. He broke into her life, stole her solitude. Her upper body required it always be held in plaster's hand. She wanted to be held in a wooden frame. His energy was an enormous room where clocks broke and calendars withered and fell to the floor. She was a bed with a looking glass on the ceiling. Art was her mirror. He was every face in the land since before the corn mothers left, every face since the revolution. The light from within her illuminated every canvas she entered. One was coyote, one was monkey, one was hammer, one was scythe, one was clock, one was not. His canvas was history. He was a stele, a stone wall. He painted murals with images that left the margins and took on lives of their own, telling their necessary stories. She was the ceramic figure, fired clay, cracked vase, blue house. She was the personal pain of the body, the damaged spine. He was the body, crushed by poverty and domination, the burdened back, shackle and brand. He was adobe wall. She painted herself as far as the frame. She was art's mirror. He was whole. His piñata was filled with salt. He wanted to be broken.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest is the poet Robert Meltner, reading from Hotel Utopia. So Robert, I'm really intrigued by the various pacing of those three poems. The first poem paces really quickly with a lot of adjectives built, and then the other two have more of a slower pace. How do you come to that decision?
Oh, that's a really good question. The work in Hotel Utopia are all prose poems. And while oftentimes the prose poem is a small, concentrated square, a single dense block, the prose poem can also be split into what are referred to as stanza graphs. Mm-hmm. The break has to do what a stanza does in poetry, and they have to function as paragraphs do in prose. So you negotiate that in those poems. So what happens is you can actually create sort of movements within the poem, pauses, you know, like you're walking through rooms in a house. The piece about the blue house is done in such a way that it's alternating very small stanza graphs. So I am able on the page to present them visually in a way that would have a reader perhaps read at the pace and pause where I would pause in the event they were listening to me. I'm trying to negotiate that distance between what we do on the page and what we do as readers of the work, because sometimes it's remarkable how fine a book of poetry is, and the reading may be good, but not maybe have the same inflections we bring into it. And there are some poets who are marvelous presenters of poetry. But without their voice, it just the singing is kind of lost on the page or on our own. And it was very much on my mind when I was constructing this book, how to make those things at least be aware of each other.
Right. It's really interesting that you can create that kind of pacing in a prose poem or don't feel limited by a block structure, you know, that you can still go in there and create musicality. That's fantastic.
It's very much a challenge in prose poetry in particular, right? Because prose walks, poetry dances, you know, prose tells and poetry sings. And so I think what I'm doing is being aware of the poetry side of the prose poem. I want the music, I want the image, and I want the cadences. And yet I'm also aware as I'm reading them that there are prose rhythms and sentences and clauses and all those pieces and components that make up prose. Maybe that's why I love the form so much. It's such a, it's like a double helix. And the satisfaction in when they work is twice as much joy, I think, as in an individual microfiction, which I also write, or verse poetry, which I also do.
Also, I'm struck by the Blue House. It was working on this sort of all these metaphors, these layer of metaphors. Do you feel really drawn to write metaphorically or even ekphrastically? You've been writing about in response to art, or even Frida Kahlo, who is an artist. I find it hard to, as a writer, to respond to pieces of art.
I'm very attracted to the relationship between multiple arts. I've recorded a CD with a guitar friend of mine who wrote original music, and I had to take pieces that I'd read aloud and knew very, very well, and I had to rephrase them to work with the music. Visual art to me is a great prompt. I think writers love prompts. You know, we just
yeah,
do.
We do.
And I hardly go to a city where I don't have a notebook with me and stop into whatever museums are there, because it's just a really great opportunity to have different colors come into my work, to have different emotions that are registered in the art come into the poem. And the details generate a kind of vocabulary that I might not normally bring into my own work. And so each piece that I use as a start, a prompt, a model, brings new things in that enrich it, and that's the joy of doing it. I'll read a piece later that in which I set out to write a poem using color the way a painter would, and not try to focus on words like a poet would.
So do you just approach the art really open-mindedly? Are you looking for something specifically when you look at it? I'm very fascinated by people that can respond to art, because I cannot do it in my own work.
There's a seek and find for me. I'll just walk through a museum with a notebook in hand. And sometimes I'll be absolutely taken by a piece and nothing goes in my notebook. Other times I find myself writing and sitting down and I'm just there for a long period of time. The work speaks to me, and it's a way that I'm kind of interrogating the work, what draws me, and it's kind of interrogating me, because it's kind of saying to me, why are you attracted to me? What's here that is of interest to you? Is it shape? Is it color? The more abstract the work is, the more complex that becomes. It's kind of, okay, it's less complicated to do a representational piece of art, you know. So in looking at a painting that's a portrait or a landscape or a building, it's very recognizable.
Right.
But I've done one on Jackson Pollock.
Right.
Yes.
I like this idea of sort of you're having a conversation with the art when you sit there, and then you you later go and craft something. Great. Could you read us some more poems?
I'd love to. I'll read the poem I was just mentioning that is based on my attempt to see how possible it might be to, by using a palette of color, if I could conceivably get that to generate a poem for me. Accident. Gray was the truck cab, black its body. Yellow the taxi in front, red the surround of the traffic signal. The tomato-faced driver eyed his watch, behind schedule with green dreams of money and lust's blue fantasies. For him, the signal was still a singing canary. For the man and the woman, the light had changed. neither could stop thinking about what he had said to her that morning. Their fingers brushed. She took his hand in the rain at the crosswalk at that hour. But the coming truck was blacktop, macadam, raven, crow. Then the umbrella slipped from her grip. Then her face was waxen in the green light, his face burnt umber turning raw sienna. Silver from the street lamps splayed on the pavement, red from the traffic light ran across the red wet asphalt. This is my outlaw poem. I think everyone should write an outlaw poem. I saw this scroll painting at the Cleveland Art Museum by a Japanese artist, Matsumara Goshen, and I was captivated with the title. So this is Water Margin Bandits. The merchants who ply this river's trade route, bent over to count coins, see neither scenery nor us. Soon they will stop, tie up at the riverbank, and nap when sleep lies on them heavy as money bags. Sudden as a thunderstorm, we will wake them, tie them to a tree with the rope from their anchor, our hands wrapped around their bags of brass and silver. We'll take all the rice wine we can find and then steal their boat. When the last bottle of wine is as empty as our threats, we will wear the merchants' coin sacks like small hats. Now we are pirates, we will laugh, drunkenly letting the current carry us like good investments. And since you were talking about the arts and visual art and the relationship, for me, art to me is very central as a philosophy for life, I guess. And I'll read this. This is The Arts, and this is dedicated to Gil Scott Heron. The arts will not be on the test. Math will be on the test because it shows how to count the numbers of homeless people the TV won't show. Helps calibrate how to pepper specks of depleted uranium across whatever land is being bombed this week. And how to estimate the amount of time needed to react to the media prompt and not to be the prompt itself. The arts will not be on the test. Science will be on the test because engineering builds equivocations effective enough to justify any hypocrisy. Physics enables occupation to be set in motion without friction. And astronomy helps the poor search the sky instead of their empty plates. The arts will not be on the test. A poem has no square root. A song has no chemical compound. A guitar solo will not fit on a bell curve. Dance cannot be reduced to a lowest common denominator, and an actor resists dissection, fights being pinned down on cotton, and a story has no mean, no mode, no medium. The arts will not be on the test. There will be no matching columns on truth and beauty, no multiple choice selections on content, no fill-ins on form, no short answer on craft, no comprehension question on aesthetics, and no essay on the state of the nation's soul. No, none of the above. The arts will not be on the test.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Robert Milner, reading from Hotel Utopia. That was great. I like that sort of list poem and the tone it creates.
Yeah, the contemporary inventory is very incantational.
Right.
You know? It's like piling detail on detail and layers and layers. And it creates an interesting music and kind of a cadence that I think kind of builds. You can feel rises and falls. And they're fun to write, but I think they're even more fun to read.
Yeah, they are fun to read. Do you think a lot about the voice? of your poems, like who the speaker might be?
Oh, heck yes. I can say that on the radio, right?
Yeah. So you have an idea in mind? Because yeah. I feel there's these varied speakers going on.
Yeah. I think that prose poetry has taken me to that. I don't write lyric poetry per se. I don't even really do very much lyric narrative. You know, those poems that Tess Gallagher says, the poet and or the poet's imagination is the hero of the action in the poem. But I find sometimes these monologic kind of pieces occur. There's sometimes a character in a painting. In the scroll painting of the Water Margin Bandits, one of the figures is actually turned and looking and very intentionally at who's viewing it. And somehow I found his voice starting to move. And so I guess it's kind of like the way an actor would work. It's kind of what happens in fiction where you find a character who starts to speak. I think that for me, a poem that has a story at the heart of it are pieces that I think work best at when we're out public reading. I do a lot of public reading. To me, it's one of the joys of what I get to do. It's kind of a variation on the idea of, you know, public intellectuals in the early part of the century, but public artistry is very important to me. And so voices and stories are what comes across to people who don't have the text in front of them. And so, yeah, when I find a voice, then I keep editing for that voice. And if you're seeing distinctions between them, then I'm doing something right.
Yeah, and it's probably also very liberating as a process because you can shed that your own personal limitations and embody something else.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's like it's not so much the persona poems of the early modernist period, but it's more like spontaneous acting almost, you know, improv in some ways. Here's a character, here's a situation, start speaking. And in some cases, whatever the prompt is that gets me going in the poem, the voice is really important to me. And his voice is important because reading the poem is very important. I think Robert Pinsky says somewhere that every poem is a musical script. And each person who reads the script brings their own voice to it. And then the idea that our bodies are musical instruments and how do we use those to play the music of the poem?
A lot of music. You're inspired by music and art?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Yes.
It's all the way around. What is your revision process like?
Oh, fanatical and obsessive.
My favorite question. Do you revise as you go? Do you write, then put it away and come back later?
How can I describe this? Most of my work comes very quickly. Sometimes when I'm driving a car, I was probably that person driving behind you erratically because I'll do that. Or I hardly ever start on the computer. I generally start by just a lot of notes. Sometimes I'm just throwing words down. I'm in and out of dictionaries. I love etymological dictionaries of going back and finding word origins because you get great sounds out of that. And then I just throw all these notes on a table and then I start to work a draft. And I try to find something out of the pile that grabs me and pulls me in. And I usually find something where I want to go. Then I work the middle. Then those drafts, I just keep working and working and shaping them on the page. One of the things I've discovered is that just as we say first idea isn't best idea, first shape isn't always best shape, best form. I have pieces that began as prose poems and became microfictions, and microfictions became prose poems, and I like the fluidity of it.
Yeah, you have to be, it sounds like you have to be very open during the revision process because that's where most of the work happens.
Yes.
Great. Can you read us some more poems?
I certainly can. In prose poetry, people who write in small blocks are called blockheads. And so when I heard that, I was really intrigued. So I wrote this poem, Blockheads, Bastards, because it's sort of a bastardized form. Yeah. And it's in three parts, so here we go. Number one, just two people simultaneous in their actions, irresponsible as teens, sneaking out at midnight to meet at the park, their eyes vivid as knives, bodies hot as lighters. Maybe responsibility, that odd man out, left somewhere around the third round of drinks when they shifted from sweet California white to a vulgar Spanish red. Two. Did Lady Poetry want to tame Mr. Prose? Or did he, if for only an instant, change from water to wine? Fusion, each thought. Blur, she whispered. Impure, he pawed. Hyphenate, they moaned. Baby, each said. 3. Caliban stands in his crib, stuck in his square, a crow calling for attention. All that glitters outside his cell will be pulled in through the bars after he learns to bend them. Ask him which wine he wants, the red or the white. Rosé, he'll reply, his tongue a sharply honed blade, his words bright as butane flames. I wrote this when my ex-father-in-law had cancer before he died. Hope. Desperate acts create their own vocabulary. So when I drove my ailing father-in-law to the cancer clinic in Buffalo, he called it worth a try. He carried his own x-rays in a large envelope as if they were his passport to another country. While he sat up on the examination table, the doctor silently moved the x-rays of the cancerous esophagus, first one way, then another, tapping them occasionally with his finger as if they were tarot cards waiting to be turned over. My father-in-law's future seemed as exposed as his own uncovered back, half gloved in a flimsy blue hospital gown. After we left the clinic, we stopped a few blocks away at a local bar, nursing Iron City drafts and avoiding eye contact. We watched a ball game on a boxy TV in the dark, narrow bar, hoping someone would win that day. The sun was setting as we drove out of the city. The car's headlights stretching out ahead on the dusking road, searching weakly for what was waiting in the dark. My father-in-law called it what's left. He called it what's next. Nostalgia. We're a nostalgic people. Our mad uncle used to scare the neighborhood kids who'd gather in the yard, grabbing them by the shoulder. That crazed stare of his, the slobbery chin, he'd whisper in their ears, "Remember." The sound like a locomotive in a tunnel growing louder. So we called him the Reptile Man, Old Horseface, Sideshow Geek, Whack Job, though we knew he was no more than an ass with a fake unicorn horse, some sane person impersonator. When Father finally locked him away in the attic, Uncle threw from the tiny windows at the top bits of paper that read, "Forget me." They fluttered to the ground like the feathers of exploded birds or the ashes of burnt martyrs. But we gathered them, piling them in a corner of the old barn, a nest of scraps, a paper igloo, scurrying in and out like lost mice, like blind orphans. The days were growing shorter. We could feel the cold pull of credulity in the air as if a train had just passed. "Uncle," we said, surrendering.
The poetry of Robert Meltner. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody 90.5 FM.